I hate to say this, it makes me sad. There's fewer and fewer people willing to learn.
Mm.
People just want to be told. Nobody wants to invest time. There's no such thing as capital without a cost.
Mm.
You either pay interest to use somebody else's capital or you give it up to use your own. And there's no in between. It's one of the two.
So today we talked to a guy named Brad Lowe. Now, Brad is in the infinite banking space. So he goes to college, gets a finance degree. Then he gets out and he starts doing irrigation. He has his own business. He gets out of that. And then he goes into understanding and trying to sell insurance with infinite banking. It takes him 2 years to fully understand and get out of debt. He starts out with zero debt, gets in lots of debt because he didn't sell a lot. And then his journey along learning IBC, selling it, and then also creating wealth on the back end. It's a wonderful story, and you're going to love this conversation with Brad Lowe. Brad, thanks so much for joining me today. So Brad is a friend of mine, but Brad also works in the office, Nallen Associates, over in Homewood. Got to know Brad and Justin and Jordan and Mike and all the guys over there. Simply because I've went down the IBC rabbit hole as far as just understanding it, using it, all of those different types of things. Brad's been in it for a long time. And there are a handful of people out there who work for people, but I feel like they're business owners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anybody in financial services, mm-hmm. whether you work for Morgan Stanley or you work for Merrill Lynch or you work for Justin Kraft over at Nallen.
Yep.
You work for that group.
Yeah.
But you have zero cap on what you can make.
True.
And I just we're walking in and we were talking about the summer and just all the things in the summer. And he goes, from Memorial Day to July 4th, I was in office about 5 days.
Yeah.
That is, in my opinion, that is the poster child for business owner.
Yeah.
And so I want to dive into all the things that you do as far as for IBC and insurance and financials. But first, let's kind of go back. Like, who are you? Where are you from? This is me. I'm at a cocktail party. Yeah, sure.
All right. First of all, thanks for having me, Thomas.
I'm glad you're here.
Glad to be here. I was born in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Okay.
1974. And I guess about 78, my family moved to Gadsden, Alabama.
Okay.
And we talked a little bit about Gadsden when you were on our podcast. Moved to Gadsden, Alabama for work for my dad. Longer story there. He was a farmer, owned a trucking company there. Got sold some bad fertilizer, caused things to go awry on the farm. As you know, farmers are highly leveraged and had to start over.
Mm.
So came to Gadsden, Alabama on his own for a little bit and decided he wanted to be an electrical contractor. So came back home, told my mom we're moving to Gadsden, Alabama. And all the family is in Kentucky. And with my mom full of tears, there we went, and I was 4 years old. I didn't know any different at the time. Yeah. So Gadsden is home to me.
Yeah.
So raised in Gadsden, went to Southside High School there. Again, my dad was an electrical contractor there. Grew up working for him. My buddies on the weekends would be hanging out, having fun. Spring break, hanging out, having fun. Summer, hanging out, having fun. I was going to work.
You were?
Going to work with my dad. And thankful for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying, like, you know, if hey, somebody asked me to go to the beach, sure, I could go to the beach with
sure.
him, whatever. But thankful for that experience. I mean, it taught me work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Got to see my dad as an entrepreneur and how he navigated that in the blue collar, on the blue collar side of things.
So let's go back to that. So it sounds like you said he was a farmer and owned a trucking company.
Mm-hmm.
So he owned,
I've only heard stories, obviously. So either had three or four 18 wheelers. He drove one a lot and he had a couple drivers work for him.
But he also had a farm. What kind of farm did he have?
Soybeans, corn, and tobacco.
So he had those farms. So, I mean, you grew up in the business owner mentality.
Yeah, that's right.
That sucker's got a farm and he owns three or four big rigs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so then he comes to me as a kid sitting on a John Deere, you know, and in his lap while he's up one row and back again, like the song says.
So he comes here and he's an electrical engineer, electrical contractor. So he owns his own electrical business in essence, and he's doing residential, commercial, whatever.
Whole nine. Yep.
Huh.
Yeah.
So just a hustler. I mean, just like figuring it out, not like.
You know, and my dad was a kind, like, I never saw him pay anybody to turn one screw on any vehicle we ever had. Like, as a little side hustle,
sure.
he would go to a junkyard and buy a car that he felt like he could fix, get it from a junkyard, get it towed to our house, park it in our driveway, and go to other junkyards, get the parts he needed, make it back whole again. And he had a buddy owned a body shop that would do the paint, but my dad did everything else. And then he would flip it, you know, and make $500.
He was flipping cars before flipping anything was cool.
That's cool. That's right. That's right.
Okay. All right.
So
you're in Gadsden learning, I mean, just seeing a business owner at work.
Yeah.
You're really your whole life.
Right.
In so many different ways. Tell me about high school. You went to Southside, I remember.
Southside High School. Didn't really do any sports there. Was on the cross country team for 1 year and on tennis team for a year. Both of those was an excuse to not go to class.
Sure. Right? So yeah.
I could get out of not have to try out. Right. Yeah. Southside was so small.
Right.
You want to be on the tennis team?
Absolutely.
You're on the tennis team.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so I wasn't good enough to do any of those. But anyway, that use that to kill time. Big outdoors, spent a lot of time hunting, fishing. You know, Gadsden's mm-hmm. on the Coosa River and Neely Henry. Spent a lot of time in the water,
yep.
fishing, swimming, skiing, boating, you know, the whole nine.
So growing up, being in a business owner mentality, when someone would say, hey, Brad, what do you want to be when you grow up? What would you say?
So my dad being a business owner, you got to remember this is before cell phones.
Yep.
Right. So we had an answer machine at the house.
Oh, yeah.
Home phone number was the work phone number.
Hmm.
And so my dad would be up at 5 a.m. First, above my mom and dad, I love the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad's routine was get up in the morning, go to the bathroom with his Bible. He was, when I was growing up, he smoked 2 packs a day of cigarettes. So he'd smoke about a pack of cigarettes, read the Bible, and drink a pot of coffee all before about 6 a.m. And
really?
Yes.
Smoked in the house.
Smoked in the house. Oh, look, we used to go visit in Bowling Green, Kentucky. We'd ride, he'd smoke 20 cigarettes from Gadsden, Alabama to Bowling Green, Kentucky, and never crack a window.
Y'all, they would put him.
Hey, Thomas Hintz, I have never had a desire to smoke a cigarette. Yeah, I couldn't. He'd crack a window, throw a butt out, and I would stick my nose up in that crack just to get a big old draw of fresh air as fast as I could.
Did your clothes smell like smoke?
Oh, everything we had smelled like an ashtray. You asked a question about what I want to be when I was a kid. So I saw my dad do that morning routine, leave the house before 7 a.m, come home at dark, whenever dark was,
mm-hmm.
generally. Mom would have supper ready. It wasn't yep. dinner, it was supper. She'd have supper ready. He would eat supper, go take a shower, and he would sit down with a yellow Liga pad at the answer machine, and he'd write down all the messages, and he'd return all the phone calls. When he got done with that, he would go set the dining room table and roll out a set of blueprints to price the next job. About that time, the 10 o'clock news would be coming on. He'd sit in a recliner, watch 10 o'clock news. You fell asleep before it was over, go get in the bed, and he'd start over again the next day.
Very little interaction with the family.
No, I mean, he would interact there, but I just saw, in my mind, I was like, he's never not working.
Mm.
Yeah, and look, he loved me, like
yeah.
he carried me fishing. I chased his heels around all sure. over Gadsden, Alabama, but he just was a hard worker.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, he didn't know. I mean, we were not poor at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I would say there was definitely times when things were lean.
Sure.
And, you know, he had the mentality, like, just work harder.
Yeah.
You know, and I got a little bit of that from him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just if you're not making enough or there's not enough deals happening or whatever, you must need to just work harder, you know. And so, but anyway, I saw him with that, and I was like, well, I like this electrical thing. It's kind of interesting, but I want to be able to, at some point, come home and not have to still be doing work. I'd like to be able to come home and not work. And so I decided we'd be on these jobs, and I'd see the Alabama Power guys, and I'd see a guy come around like in a button-up shirt with a legal pad and point around, tell some people what to do, and get back in his truck. And I was like, Dad, what's that guy do? He's an electrical engineer. I was like, I'm going to be an electrical engineer.
Because
that guy is telling the hardworking guys what to do. He's riding around in the truck with air conditioning, which, by the way, my dad, until I was in college, never had a vehicle with air, a work vehicle with air conditioning.
God bless him.
He said, because you can't survive. You can't work in 100-degree heat and ride around the air conditioning, hop out and work. You need to just roll the window down.
Mm.
And so
God,
that's what we did. That's what we did in the summer, rode around with the windows down, sweated. And to be honest with you, like, I'd hear my friends talk about how hot it was. I'm like, what do you mean? It's not, it's mm-hmm. just normal. You know, he's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so anyway, that was when I was young.
Yeah.
And then later on, like through high school and whatnot, I got interested watching ER and whatever. I was like, you know what, I might want to be a doctor. That sounds fun.
Yeah.
And so I went to I was a late bloomer. So I would say when I graduated high school, I was fairly immature.
Okay.
My mom and dad saw that, and so they said, we don't think you're I wanted to go, anyway, lifelong Bama fan, but I wanted to go to Auburn because that's where my buddies are going, which is coincidentally where my son's,
going
in a couple weeks. But he, they're like, you're not ready to go away to college. That aggravated me, made me mad. So anyway, I went to Gadsden State for 2 years. Turns out they were right about that, like parents are a lot of time. They were right. So thankful for that. You know, went to school 8 to noon every day, worked for my dad every afternoon, and
made a little money.
Made a little bit of money. And then ended up going to Birmingham Southern College.
Oh.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
For Birmingham
Southern. That's a hard college to get into back then.
Well, dang, it's not as hard as Auburn and these other places are to get in now.
I think college has changed, though.
It's changed.
It's changed pretty good. I remember
I couldn't have gone anywhere with my test scores.
Birmingham Southern, though, had a mystique of, like, being academic.
Yeah. And I think maybe it was because I was in junior college for 2 years.
Sure.
And, you know, I was, to put it gently, Southside High School was not the most rigorous academic curriculum.
Yeah, I went to one too.
I didn't have to study really. I didn't make great grades.
Yeah.
You know, I made B's and some C's.
Yep, I'm with you.
But, like, I made B's and some C's and never cracked a book for anything.
Yeah.
I just listened a little bit in class or not and, you know, make a B on the test or whatever.
Right, and be fine with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I went to Gadsden State and kind of the same way. I studied maybe a little.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I tried to pull that trick when I got to Birmingham Southern.
Oh, no.
That didn't work out.
No.
So, had to retake a couple classes that I failed first semester. And then, you know, after that, you know, only made a few C's, a lot of B's. I was a B guy.
B guy.
Yeah, I was a B guy.
That's okay.
But anyway, so ended up graduating Birmingham Southern in 1997. When I was there, I at least had the wherewithal. I say I had the wherewithal. And the Lord gave me the idea, like, hey, don't be a biology major. Mm-hmm. Because if this med school things don't work out, you probably don't want to teach biology.
No.
And, you know, most of my buddies that were hardcore, I'm medical school or dental school or bust, were either biology or chemistry majors.
So what did you major in?
Finance.
Okay.
So I was like, I want to have another
plan B.
I want to have plan B.
Yeah.
And so majored in finance. Anyway, being a B guy, you know, with a C or two mixed in, I realized nearing the end of my junior year and it was time to take the MCAT. I was like, this is futile. Like,
they're not going to do it.
Not going to do it. Like, I'm not going to take these last couple of pre-med classes.
Sure.
I'm not going to take the MCAT. Like, I'm not going to be able to get in anywhere.
Right.
So just finished out with finance degree, graduated in 97. Well, I had the idea then at the time, hey, I still like the medical thing. And I had met a couple people that at the time, I mean, that was the glory days of pharmaceutical reps or medical sales reps in the 90s. And I
was
like, these guys.
Back then, there were no rules.
No rules. You spend as much money.
You spend as much money as you, of the company's money as you want, entertain these people, and you could make truckloads of money.
Truckloads. And all while taking people to play golf and deep sea fish and everything.
Yeah.
And I was like, that sounds like
that's
a pretty good gig.
Oh, so you got into that.
Well, so I wanted to get into that.
Yeah.
And so as I'm trying to interview around at the end of college, first thing I'm realizing is I can't just get into that. Like, most of this are pretty women or ex-college athletes like yourself or whatever. Yeah. And I understand that. Or even military. I knew folks that were, you know, been in the military for a while and did that, right?
Right.
For all those reasons of discipline and,
yeah,
you know, all that. I was like, well, if I'm going to try this, I got to get some sales experience. Otherwise, prove my track record that way.
Sure.
Then maybe I'll have a shot at it.
Yeah.
Well, as I'm interviewing for some sales jobs, including like even like going to work for the bank, you know, be a teller, you know, interview with Merrill Lynch, that kind of really wasn't lighting my fire then, but I was still interested in it. My dad called, I guess maybe in about March of my senior year. I was about to graduate in May. And he's like, hey, I need to ask you a favor. And it's a pretty big one. I was like, shoot, Dad. Because he'd already asked me about, hey, do you want to come kind of run the business, take over after college? And I was like, you know, I'd seen his struggles with, you know, labor and trying to get help and everything. I was like, you know what? I'm ready to do something different. I've never done anything else since, as far as I can remember, work-wise, except for do that. He said, I got a big favor. He said, I've bid 2 jobs, one of which was the Sunday school building, for lack of a better word, First Baptist Church of Boaz, Alabama.
Okay.
The other was new gymnasium and locker rooms, Hoax Bluff High School.
Oh, big jobs.
Two big commercial jobs. He wanted to bid on both of them. And so my dad never had really project manager type guys working for him. He was the project manager, and he really just had labor. And he said, could you give me 18 months after college? And I'll let you run one of these, and I'll run one of them so I can do them both. I mean, well, you're not going to tell your dad.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
in that situation.
Yeah. And so I said, sure, absolutely. So I moved back to Gadsden after graduation. I did the Hooks Bluff High School gymnasium, and he did the Boaz one. You know, and that was, for those people that aren't familiar with Gadsden, you know, our home base was in Gadsden. Those are both about 35 or 40 minutes-ish drive from where our house was, which that's not super far, but they're opposite directions.
Opposite directions.
So those two jobs were hour and 15, hour and 20 apart. It was logistically just too hard.
Why he needed your help.
Yeah. If they were, you know, 5 minutes down the road from one another, he could have done them both without me, you know, but he needed somebody. And so anyway, gave my dad that experience. And so then as I'm nearing the end of that, end up with, I'm just going start to finish in the story. Stop me here.
Yeah.
But as I'm nearing completing those, I start interviewing for other jobs. I didn't want to live in Gadsden. I want to be back
sure.
in Birmingham. Interviewing around and came across, so there's a company called Tyco, T-I-E-C-O. That stands for Turf and Industrial Equipment. Not in business anymore. But back in the day, they did seed, fertilizer, ball washers, greens mowers, fairway mowers, flag sticks.
Yeah.
You know, anything for a golf course, irrigation. They did some landscape lighting, they did all those things. Well, that was owned by a fraternity brother friend of mine's family owned that business. And another fraternity brother or two of mine were working there. So I was like, hey, this would be a great place for me to just start, get some sales experience, you know, whatever.
One of the largest advantages to college is not what you're learning in the classroom. It's the relationships you make.
You're spot on.
And who you get to know. I told my daughter this the other day. The relationship, I looked at her the other day, and she talks about, she's got these two friends that she's just like, she's best friends with, and she's starting high school. And I said, hey, baby, they're wonderful, and I love them. I said, but you're probably not going to be friends with them the rest of your life.
Yeah.
She goes, what do you mean? Like, she was shocked. I'm like, hey, baby, I got one friend from high school. I said, you know why I'm friends with him? Because we went to college together, and we played ball together. I said, the people that you make do life with in college are the ones that will most likely be there for a long, long time, because it's the first time ever you get to live life independently with someone other than your family.
Yeah.
And that like dynamic is part of the reason why I still think college is important. Now, let me say this. Will my kids go to college? If they play sports, they will. I don't know that they will. If they don't play sports, if they will.
Yeah.
But that's the main reason I love college
yeah.
is because of those relationships.
Well, I mean, that's what I've told my oldest, who's going to be entering his freshman year of college in a week or so. I've told him, like, hey, he's kind of an entrepreneurial mind. He's cut yards. He's always looking for work to do, you know, around, you know, to make some money or whatever. And he feels like he wants to be some sort of business owner, start
sure.
a business, buy a business, something. I said, if that's the case, here's what's important. You need to study and have a good enough transcript to get a diploma
yep.
from Auburn University. Outside of that, you need to make as many and as deep a relationships as you can.
That's it.
That's where success is going to come from.
Go later. On trips. Find the people that are like at least a little bit like-minded. Find hard workers. Don't
yep.
find a bunch of slap
yep.
jocks. Don't, yep. I mean, just get with people that are doing life well and
yeah.
go spend tons of time with them.
Yeah, and I'd say, hey, like when you go home with a buddy,
yes.
a fraternity brother or whatever, and you see his dad successful, pick his brain.
Ask him questions.
And just listen.
Great advice.
And so anyway, they had a couple of outside salesmen called on golf courses. I was like, well, that's what I want to do. A couple of them were older, and they were both nearing retirement.
Mm.
So they hired me to come kind of shadow one of those guys and – you know, do his deliveries for him, meet his customer base for a couple of years, and then I was going to take over his territory. That was the initial plan. When they hired me, I said, I need about 30 days to get wrapped up on this job in Gadsden before I start.
Yeah.
And they were totally okay with that. And so when I went back, in between when they hired me and when I started, their irrigation salesperson inside on the counter quit. And so when I showed up for work, they're like, hey, we're going to need some help in here till we find a replacement for this guy. It's like, whatever. Yeah, I work for
yeah,
you. Tell me what to do.
Coach me up and let's
yeah,
go.
Didn't know one single thing about irrigation, but irrigation, if you don't know, lawn sprinklers, you know, water
yeah.
yards, commercial and golf course, the whole nine, this pipe and wire.
Yeah.
Well, I've been dealing with pipe and wire my whole life. Yeah. So I was a pretty quick study. There was nothing complicated about that to me. I feel like, you know, it was harder for me to learn the part numbers and stuff than it was to understand
right.
like how this works,
the concept.
How to design one, how to put it together. The
yeah.
They thought I was good at it evidently because they're like, well, we just want you to do this full time. we're not going to put you outside sales. And I'm like, well, I kind of popped my bubble because, yeah. I mean, I guess this is sales experience inside, but it's not getting me down the road that I want to be down to go this medical sales route. Well, while I'm there working, another guy gets hired there and we become close. We were similar in age, had the same birthday, matter of fact, but a couple years apart. And we became tight, hunted together. And he and I started noticing these irrigation contractors that would come in there with a white t-shirt with a mustard stain on it, smelling like a wet ashtray. And I'd have to go out to the job because they couldn't get it to work right. You know, help them design it for them, help them get it working right. And they are killing it, making money hand over fist. And he and I kind of look at each other and we're like,
I got the nice polo on.
Yeah.
And Rick with the mustard stain is making a lot more money than I am.
Yeah. You remember when Ford came out like way back when, like, and they special ordered like the Ford GT, like,
yeah,
like way back, like this is early, like at this point, this is 99, 2000, yeah. 2001. One of those jokers came in, was like, got my Ford GT on order. And I was like, that's it.
I'm done.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so he and I endeavored in middle of 01, we decided we're going to start our own business.
Okay.
We're going to be a couple college educated guys. We're going to do what we say we're going to do. We're going to show up on time.
Yeah.
Can't be there on time, we're going to call you and tell you why we can't be on time.
Yeah.
That was our whole business model. Do what you say you're going to do, show up on time. And if you
can't, what service were you going to provide?
Irrigation. Landscape lighting.
Okay.
No landscaping, just irrigation for sports fields, a little bit golf courses, mostly sports fields, commercial jobs, and residential, right? 70% residential, 30% the other two.
Yeah.
And then landscape lighting in the wintertime to bridge a gap when people don't have their sprinkler turned on.
Right.
So about the time we're deciding to do that is when I meet my wife. So this is 01.
Okay.
So my parents love the Lord. They went on their first mission trip to Nigeria when I was in the fourth grade.
Okay.
So let's see. I'm 50. I would have been 9. That would have been 1983.
Okay.
They went on a mission trip in Nigeria. And that struck a chord in them about doing mission work. They didn't go on another mission trip for 8 or 9 years. And I would say early 90s, about the time I graduated high school, they started going on a mission trip to India once a year. It was always like end of January through beginning of February. And they went with the organization called Tom Cox Ministries. So Tom Cox Ministries was one of these. Any relation?
Wow. That's weird.
Yeah. No kidding. Tom, his wife was named Kay.
Yeah.
Your wife's not
nope,
Kay.
No, it's Jackie.
Yeah. Anyway, Tom Cox Ministries, they would put together, these are all medical mission trips.
Okay.
But they would assemble a team of 50 or 55 people. So they would travel around and speak at churches here, and they would assemble a team of 55 people from 12 or 15 different churches, you know, all around the country.
Yep.
And so generally they would meet somewhere, you know, Dallas, Chicago, some international airport. The whole team would meet there with, you know, over-the-counter medicine, what prescriptions that the doctors could travel legally with, assemble that in suitcases, travel over and spend 2 weeks in India doing medical missions, sharing the gospel the whole night. Well, how that relates to my wife is Tom Cox came to her church in Meridian, Mississippi, which is where my wife was born and raised. She went to Mississippi State, majored in painting, graduated in 2000. I graduated Birmingham Southern in 1997.
Okay.
So at the beginning of 2001, she goes on this mission trip with Tom Cox Ministries.
Meet your folks.
Meets my folks in India.
Mm.
That's 2001. They come back and they keep in touch. My mom keeps in touch. Well, there was a lot of people keeping in touch because she was the only single girl on the trip, you know, and everybody's got a son or a grandson or a nephew,
yeah,
whatever. Well, just so happened, one of the pastors from India came to the States to speak, and one of the churches he was going to speak at was my parents' church in Gadsden. My mom calls Cecily, my wife's name, calls Cecily and says, hey, Pastor so-and-so, come to speak at our church. You want to come to Gadsden? Spend a couple nights with us. Well, I lived in Birmingham, so that doesn't really,
yeah,
I mean, and I wasn't interested in, you know, your mom says, this is sweet, sweet girl, you need to meet her.
Yeah, sure.
Take that with a grain of salt, usually. But the just so happened that coincided with my birthday, which is in July. And so I drove to Gadsden on my birthday because I knew I'd get money. I'd get
hang out
cash,
with you. And, yeah, and see your folks.
And see my folks. Well, I met my wife at my parents' house in Gadsden.
How about that?
In July of 01. We got engaged in February of 02, married in September of 02.
How about that?
So, God's providence.
Yeah. Yeah.
10 out of 10.
Praise God for a mission trip.
Yeah. That's right. Never could have orchestrated that. No possible way ever would have met anybody from Meridian, Mississippi, had it via India on a mission trip.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Mm.
So we got married in September of 2002.
Okay.
We started this business in February of 2003. Okay. So she knew me getting a paycheck from Tyco for about 4 months.
Okay.
And then we're out on our own. Ooh. Have been ever since, one, some shape, form or another.
Right.
Well, fast forward that business was great. We did well. You know, if you could have, I'd probably still have that business, still be doing it if we lived in an area where there was not wintertime. Or, because you couldn't get to everything and you did really well, great margin, great volume.
During mowing season, you can't get to everything.
Yeah, for about 8 months.
But for 3.5 months a year, it's anemic.
It is. And so we'd save up this big pile. And then, when phones started ringing again in early March, your pile was not a pile anymore. Start the whole process.
That's hard.
It's always just a big reset.
Yeah.
And we tried a bunch of ways. I was a firm believer even then in my young neophyte entrepreneurial mind, you got to have some residual. You got to have some recurring, right?
Yeah.
You can't have to put your hand on everything that brings a dollar in.
Correct.
Right? It's okay to start that way, but you got to get to a place where you got some residual.
Sure.
We tried every model we could think of to do that. So a lot of our buddies in the landscaping world, their residual was maintenance. So their lawn maintenance, they got a check every month because even though they didn't go in the winter, they'd spread it out where they build on a 12-month cycle instead of building on an 8-month cycle.
Correct.
Right? That's where we got all our business. Mm. All of our referrals came from those guys. So we didn't want to step on their toes and go try to do that. So that got left to the side. Anyway, long story short, my partner and I started realizing 08, 09 that it was going to be, we were going to have to be in the ditch the rest of our life to do this. And at the time I was mid-30s, he was early 30s. If you're gonna reset, you better not delay.
That's the time.
At this point. And so anyway, we mutually decided, hey, let's both explore other opportunities. And whoever finds an opportunity first, the person that stays behind will buy the person that's leaving.
When you guys decided to dissolve the business, did you have any debt?
A little bit. Yeah.
Business debt?
Most of our debt. So we would run out 90 to 120 days on supply debt. Mm. We didn't have like business credit card debt. We didn't owe money on real estate. We had financed a couple of vehicles, but those were all paid for at the time. And I take that back. There's one vehicle that was not paid for yet, but we owned all our equipment at the time. So, but it netted out, really the business was really worth what you could create out of it. It wasn't like a business that you could sell for a big amount of money. It netted out. It wasn't worth a lot because our supplier debt versus like what you had up. The business really worth what the equipment and what you had on hand was, right?
Yeah.
Our intellectual capital and our client base.
Book.
Yeah, wasn't really worth a lot to many people, right?
Okay. So you get out of the irrigation business. What did you go do then?
So as we're deciding to do this, this is late 09, early 2010. My buddy Chad Mosley, that also works at Nallen.
Okay.
Fraternity brother, which again, college connection, that's how I ended up at Nallen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he had done what little financial advising that for my wife and I up to that time that we had capacity to do or that he could help us with. He hands me in the fall winter of 09 going into 10, copy of Becoming Your Own Banker. And he said, hey, you need to read this book. They didn't teach us this at Birmingham Southern. I was like, what do you mean teach us this? He's like, just read it. I was like, okay.
So he's working with Justin. Mm-hmm. This is, and Justin met
Dan
Nelson.
And still, yeah.
Justin met Nelson in what, 2008,
I think.
Eight or so. This is really new in the office.
Yeah, pretty new.
So Chad gives you a copy of Becoming Your Own Banker. What happens then?
It goes to live on my coffee table.
Perfect.
and might still be sitting there had he not called me in about 3 weeks and asked me, have you read it?
Right.
And my response is, well, no, I haven't, but I'm going to. And he says, I don't believe you are. Let's meet up tomorrow. I want you to give it back to me. So like all good friend relationships, I've got to prove him wrong.
Sure.
So I hang the phone up and immediately start reading it.
Yeah.
And I get about halfway through to page 45, CD Sister, and I text him and I said, I'm going to give your book back tomorrow. I'm about halfway through it, but we got to talk.
Hmm.
And we did. Interesting, things that work and resonate kind of seem to always work and resonate. He showed me a couple of things, a couple of calculators then that I still use today. kind of to introduce some things to people regarding infinite banking, IBC. So anyway, my wife and I became a client of his in 2010.
Okay.
And we were a client for about a year. So in May of 2011, my business partner got a job offer. I was already working on my insurance license because I thought I might want to do this. He goes to work. I buy the business from him, buy the half for him, and end up selling the business to a landscaper guy that we used to work with
okay.
in September, and went to work full-time at Nylon September 2011.
So when you go to work at Nylon for the first time, what did you start doing?
Evangelizing IBC.
Okay. So you weren't in securities at the time?
No, not at all. And so, I mean, I was, and so that, you know, that was over much prayer. I'll tell you another neat story. See God's hand on things. My wife and I prayed about it because that's a big deal. Yeah, hey, I'm going to sell this business and I'm going to just start from scratch.
Start from zero.
I'm 37 years old. Like, hey, what am I going to do?
Right.
And I had told my wife, I said, Cecily, it was blowing my mind. Like some of the things we'll get to, like in a minute, what was really light bulb for me with IBC, but it was blowing my mind. And I was trying to tell people about it. Well, nobody wants to hear about their money from the sprinkler guy.
Oh, there's no doubt.
A lot of people don't want to hear about their money from the finance guy, but that's a different story.
Right.
I just said, I feel like people need to hear this and nobody's going to listen if this is not my vocation.
Mm.
This needs to be my career. So we prayed. It was kind of coming to the end, like, hey, no turning back, selling a business, you know, chips are all in. Yeah. You know, I prayed and I said, Lord, seems like you've made this clear. If we continue down this road, my promise to you is just guide me. And my promise to you is I will bless every single meal with every client that I ever meet with.
Mm.
The very first client meeting, get this, we had Mexican restaurant. We sat down and I had done sprinkler work for this guy.
Mm.
And I had heard him talk. His wife worked for like Accenture or something, was in India, like coincidentally, had to go to India, you know, probably a third of the year she spent in India.
Oh, wow.
They killed it. Like, huge house. They paid us a bunch of money. I knew they had money. We sat down and they bring the chips and salsa. They set our plate down. I was like, hey, man, you mind if I bless it? And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, well, you can do whatever you want, but I'm an atheist. And I said, I believe I'll go ahead and pray for us.
Yeah.
And I prayed for us. I don't have any idea. That was the last conversation I had with that guy.
Yeah.
But I prayed for our meal and we had an okay conversation and that was it. But how about like the very first opportunity?
The first time the Lord
was like, well, let's see if you are.
Let's see if you are. That's so, great.
Anyway, that was my very first client meeting over a meal.
So let's talk about this. So you're in this now because some people get and understand infinite banking. Some people hate it because they've heard Dave Ramsey talk about it in a negative light. And some people are drinking the Kool-Aid with a fire hose. What was the light bulb moment for you with infinite banking?
All right. So the light bulb moment for me, we had, I don't mind. I mean, we could do the first year. I had about 10 grand
mm-hmm.
I could put in a policy
back
in 2010. We threw 10 grand in there and we owed a little bit. We were saving a little bit of money a month. At the time, we owed $3,500 on a car or something.
Yeah.
You know, my wife's car. We owed on it. We put 10 grand in there and we took a loan and paid the car off. And then all of a sudden, not only are we saving what we were saving, now we're saving that car payment amount on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the light bulb of, regardless of what I ever do with this money, the amount of money I'm going to put back or save is going to be 10x what I would have done had I not known about this. Because once money goes into one of these policies structured right, obviously, there's cash drag in the first year. You don't have access to all the money. We'll get into mechanics in a little bit. But once you get to year two, basically you put a dollar in, you got access to a dollar.
Sure.
Close enough. And I just thought, like, you know, if you're going to ask me to send money to a mutual fund or whatever, and I feel like I need to let that ride until I'm 65, that check is so much smaller than the check I'm willing to write over here when I know if Murphy shows up next month, like he always does, I can get it right back. That was kind of the light bulb for me. I'm like, people get hung up on returns. You know, just the, had you rather have $10 million earning 4% or 100 grand earning 10%?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like my, you know, what kind of light bulb that went off. It's like, we're going to be able to save and put away so much more money than I ever thought we would be able to.
Right.
And that was even thinking around income parameters that were in place then, which have changed dramatically now. But that was kind of our light bulb.
Tell me about your first policy. You said $10,000 policy.
Mm-hmm. So $10,000 policy, you know, then like we talked a lot about, and it absolutely is, infinite banking is for this. And these are the examples that Nelson uses in Becoming Your Own Banker. A lot of examples of how to be the bank, basically, and you control your own debt, mm-hmm. right? And it can be, absolutely, I've helped a bunch of clients this way, and it's helped us some as a tool to, instead of throwing extra money straight at debt, let's run it through here and then get rid of the debt. So we're creating an asset as we're getting rid of the debt.
Correct.
And a beautiful, beautiful way to do that. Now everything's kind of morphed more, not that we don't do that, but morphed more to how can we give entrepreneurs, real estate investors, business owners access to more capital so that they can do more of what they know and understand. How can we use infinite banking as a tool to just create a larger pool of capital for them?
Right.
And so that's kind of what it's morphed into. But in our first policy was really like, hey, here's an alternative. Let's get rid of this little car payment, you know.
Yeah. Super simple.
Super simple. No, I mean, nothing complicated about that. You know, and
so in your first IBC policy, you put $10,000 in the first year. Mm-hmm. You had access to what, $6,500?
About $6,500.
You paid the car off mm-hmm. with $3,500 of that. Mm-hmm. You had access to $6,500.
Yeah.
You paid the car off with $3,500.
Yeah.
But then you took the car payment.
Yep.
Instead of paying the bank, you paid back Brad and Cecily.
Yeah.
And you just started paying yourself back.
Yeah, and that car payment at the time was plus minus a few bucks, $325.
Yeah.
So small car payment. Well, so by the first policy anniversary, we had it just about filled back up, you know, and then I was really like, I mean, so you got to think.
So you had a car.
Yeah.
And you still got the $10,000.
Yeah.
Or you still got the $3,500.
Yeah. And we didn't spend, our cash flow didn't change one penny.
Mm.
Our cash flow was exactly the same.
Wow.
And that's what a lot of, every scenario we try to build, we try to show our clients, and even when for my own, I try to build these scenarios out where I don't want cash flow to ever change. I'm not trying to say like, hey, don't go on the vacation so we can put that money in here.
Sure.
Instead, I'm saying like, hey, let's look at all the places money are moving, and let's just add this as a stepping stone. Let's keep the money moving just like it's moving. Let's just add this as a stepping stone where it moves through here as it does these other things.
Correct.
Yeah.
If someone was interested in IBC, what's the first thing they should do?
Read Becoming Your Own Banker.
Hands down.
Now, obviously, you know, you taught somebody like me, Mike, you know, John, Jordan, you know,
yeah.
Justin, anybody, Chad, my buddy. Now, I mean, anybody that is well-versed, but I would say I'd be remiss if I didn't say that would be the first step. There's lots of tools and information out there. I mean, you've been on our podcast. We've mm-hmm. got a podcast now. We've got educational tools on our website, but there is, that would be building block one.
It's the basis. So, how many policies do you have now?
We have 5 insurance policies, 4 banking policies, and a big term policy to convert.
Whenever.
Yep.
So you run a lot through those 4 policies.
As much as possible.
Okay. Do you have a 401k?
I have one of the carriers that we write business through offers a Roth 401k.
Yeah.
And they match 50 cents on the dollar.
Oh, wow. Free money.
I do enough in the Roth to maximize their match, and that's it.
That's not bad at all.
Yeah. If they didn't have the Roth option, I don't think I would do it. For me personally. Not saying that a regular 401k is bad or not.
Right. So
I just feel like taxes are coming home to roost.
They are.
On everybody.
So people in all walks of life, all businesses, they've got an avatar of the person that's their ideal client.
Mm-hmm.
Real estate agents are high end, you know, houses over $750,000 in these 4 neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance people, financial advice. I'll give you a great example. The guy that handles our finances, 90% of his clients are college and pro football coaches.
Okay.
So he is really, really niche.
Yeah.
So who is your ideal client for infinite banking?
Well, let me tell you who my clients are. I would say probably 80% of my client base is either serial entrepreneur, real estate investor, business owner.
Got it.
The reason that I would say 80% of my client base is that group of people is because those group of people are those things because they're always learning and educating themselves financially.
Mm.
Somebody that's not willing to take some time and learn. Nelson used to say infinite banking is caught, not taught.
Sure. Ooh, yeah, it is.
You gotta dig into it. You gotta learn. You're gonna get answers. They're gonna create more questions. And you gotta be willing to continue to peel that back and decide for yourself if it's right for you, not take the word of a financial entertainer on the radio.
Mm. Okay, so this is very technical. What is the simplest way for someone to use IBC in everyday life?
So let me just tell you how I use it.
Okay, great.
If you ask the question, can I use IBC for X? If you could take out IBC and put savings account and it be yes, the answer is yes.
That's a great answer.
So I use my, a lot of people will say I have a minimum I want to keep in the bank. Like sure. I reserve my emergency fund. I have that too, but I also have a maximum. There's a range of money I want at the bank proper. When it starts to exceed that maximum, I don't want it there anymore. It's not efficient.
Correct.
So my conglomerate of four IBC policies function as as excess is getting created, money is getting shoved over there as fast as I can shove it. Premium first, paid up rider second, loan repayment third, in that order. And that's how I allocate. If I start creeping down in my bank accounts to like at that threshold, hey, I'm kind of getting, below that reserve number, then yeah. I just start moving money back. And it's a revolving door. And obviously the IBC side is blowing up. And then we use that for future opportunities, whatever those are.
So this is a great question. I love this question. So what is that range in your savings account in the bank?
Just use it on a month perspective. Like for me, and I don't have a savings account. It just stays in the checking account.
Yeah.
I don't have a savings account proper at the bank. IBC is my savings account.
Right.
My whole life policies are my savings account. So, I want to have at least about 2 months of expenses
okay.
to run my business, all the things we need to do for the household, everything kind of always hanging around.
So your number is 2 months of your monthly expenses in your checking account. You want to hang at that number
I'd love to hang at that number. And if I get to 3 months, I start looking ahead and see what's coming. Like, do I have revenue coming that's going to make this continue to increase? When I get to 4 months, I start moving.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's a great way to look at it. I love that.
And so it's because you don't have to, with IBC, the I stands for infinite.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
With IBC, you don't have to say, like with a 529, this money is for college.
Mm-hmm.
Right? With a 401k, this money is for retirement. Right? With IBC, it's infinite. So I don't have to know what it's going to do before it goes over there.
Right.
I just know that that's the best place for it to live until I decide what I'm going to do.
Correct. That's really good.
Yeah.
What's the hardest part about teaching infinite banking?
Man, I'm going to go back to that other question. And I hate to say this. It makes me sad. There's fewer and fewer people willing to learn.
Mm.
People just want to be told, nobody wants to invest time.
I do. Like, there are some things in life, Brad.
Yeah.
Like, I'll look at her, Sierra. I'll just say, hey, tell me, what do I need to do here?
Yep.
Or I'll look at the account, my tax guy.
Yeah.
Hey, tell me, Jason, tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And in some people's financial lives, they want to be told, hey, just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Like for example, we still dollar cost average every month.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe in having some exposure to the market.
Yeah, me too.
So we dollar cost average every month, and I don't screw with it.
Yeah.
I send it to Mark. Mark's team allocates it however he sees fit.
Yep.
And we don't mess with it.
Yep.
Like, I don't have the time and the effort and the brain power to go down that rabbit hole, to go down the tax rabbit hole. Now, there are some things I will go down.
Right.
But some people are like that. And I get that.
Yeah.
But this is not that thing.
Yeah.
You need to, if you can understand and catch this concept, it can change your life. But you got to get it and you got to catch it.
Yep. You do. Yeah. And we tell... When I said a minute ago, 80% of my client base is real estate investors, serial entrepreneurs, business owners. The highest and best use of that group of people's capital, really anybody, is to invest in things that you know and understand. Correct?
Okay. So I was reading this last, it's so funny you asked this question. So I was reading this last night. And so before Charlie Munger passed away, someone asked Charlie Munger, who's Charlie Munger is Warren Buffett's,
yep.
Business partner for years.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, because they're huge investors and believers in Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. They understand the business. They understand the model. And the guy, this kid asked him a question. He says, hey, where did Apple go wrong in this other thing? And he sits there and he goes, I'm not knowledgeable enough about that topic to answer succinctly.
Mm. Okay to say that.
It's okay to say that.
Yep.
You don't have to make something up.
That's right.
And a lot of people don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some things that we can learn that can change the trajectory of our future. And I think this is one of them.
That's right. And so, like, I'd ask you, Thomas, what would, as a business owner, and you've owned more than one, mm-hmm. still own more than one, right?
Yeah.
What's the limiting factor or factors that limit you in being able to take that business to what your wildest dream is out in the future?
Oh, it's number one A and one B are hiring and capital to hire.
Access to capital.
I knew where you were going, because I know the answer.
Yeah.
It's access to capital. Now, there are two things that I think that access to capital does. Number one, it allows you to buy things when they're available
mm-hmm.
that may not be available when you have the excess.
Yeah.
So, for example, where we buy our cars and trucks for the business, he calls me tomorrow and says, I've got a truck available. I have to buy it.
Yeah.
And if I don't have access to capital, it could be a year, 2 years before I could have access to buy that thing again.
Yeah.
Because he's got a list
yep.
a mile long of people who can buy these vehicles.
Yeah.
Being able to buy that thing at that time sets you up for so much success.
100%.
Because if I can do that thing then when I don't need it, or I can hire that huge. We're like, we're kind of in a limbo stage right now with hiring.
Mm-hmm.
I got a person I need to hire. I don't quite have the revenue
yeah.
to hire that human. But if I could hire and eat the time, it would make a difference down the road.
Yeah. So, pretend you don't know anything about IBC. Mm-hmm. You're a business owner, and I say, Thomas, if over the next 10 years, I could create a strategy for you where you would have 1.5 to 1.75x the amount of access to capital, would you be willing to spend a little time to learn how we can do that?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's all we're trying to do with IBC.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be trying to, but you're not my client. You're Mike and Justin, right?
Yeah.
Mike and Justin are not trying to change anything you're doing.
No.
They're trying to help you have more capital to take more advantage of those opportunities, whether it's buying a truck, whether it's hiring somebody, whether it's expanding in whatever way that you feel is the best way to expand.
Nelson used to say this, because Justin tells me this all the time. And the guy I'm talking about, Justin, is Justin Craft. He owns Nylon Associates. Mm-hmm. Wonderful mentor, both of ours.
Yep.
Justin says, whatever you're going to do in business, do it well. Real estate, food, whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever you're going to do, do it well. And be in the banking business.
Right.
Not in the banking business of where, like, I've got 1,000 clients and I've got a branch on Main Street, but be the banker for you and your family.
Yeah.
Be the banker for the people in your extremely close sphere, whether it be just your wife and your kids.
And you know what Nelson would add to that?
What's that?
He would say the exact same thing. Justin got that from Nelson.
Yeah.
And Nelson would say, and of those two, the most important one is the banking business.
It is. It is the most important thing. And I've learned so much just in the last 2 years about how it can change the trajectory of your life.
Nelson would say, you don't get the opportunity to choose to participate or not.
Yeah.
Banking is.
That's right.
What he would mean by that is there's no such thing as capital without a cost.
Mm.
You either pay interest to use somebody else's capital or you give it up to use your own. And there's no in between. It's one of the two.
But if you're in the banking business, meaning you have IBC and you can run money through IBC, you can be that person.
That's
and you can capitalize not only on your expenditures and your intake and your outflow, but you can capitalize on there's not near as much of lost opportunity there.
Yeah, that's true. And look, if Nelson was here, he would shake his head at me so hard right now for what I'm about to say. I'd say it anyway. I wouldn't be behind his back. Nelson would say, you should never use any capital other than what comes from your whole life policies, other than what comes from your infinite banking mm-hmm. system. My personal view is if you're doing infinite banking, you got three ways to access capital.
Okay.
You can use your cash in the bank. You can go borrow from the bank proper, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, whoever, or you can use your system. Whatever client I have, if it's a major capital expense, I want us to explore all three of those options. Because the math will tell us exactly which one of those dollars of capital costs the least, right? And even if IBC costs the least, we may not choose to use our policies for that right then. Let me give you an example. So like if you have a smaller amount of money in the bank, you got large amounts of capital in your whole life policies doing infinite banking, and you're a credit worthy guy, high net worth, you have access to lots of capital at the bank.
Right.
Let's say you're in the real estate world. If there's a laydown deal down the road, industrial laydown deal, you know, a couple, $3 million, the folks aren't in a hurry. It's not on market. You found out about it. You talked to your banker. He's more than willing to loan you the money for it. And the seller is more than willing to wait for closing to happen.
Right.
We might choose to use the bank's money for that because 2 weeks later, there might be a deal that hits the market that we didn't know about. And we need to call that guy. We need to say, I can close with cash, not close in 7 days.
For sure.
We may need to protect our capital for that deal. So we may take advantage of, hey, we have time and ability to use bank's money right now.
Every situation is different.
That's right. So we just do the math. People get hung up on rate. I want to know the volume. That's what Nelson would say, or the dollar amount.
Right.
So the rate doesn't always tell us the dollar amount.
Mm.
And a higher rate may be a lesser dollar amount, depending on how the deal's structured or whatever the case is. So we want to compare dollar amounts to dollar amounts, not rates to rates.
Not rates. Yeah. Mm. Let's go like into your finances. How much wealth do you have in the market?
Tell you right now,
percentage-wise,
probably 25.
Okay, 25%. So you still have exposure to the market.
Yeah.
What else do you invest in besides the market?
So yeah, we keep a lot of capital in all of our dry powder in our policies, and so kind of peel the onion back. So I started this business in 11.
Okay.
I paid that car off. Yep. We started this business. We had zero debt except for our first mortgage on our house. That's it. No, the only debt we had. That was in 2011. We went from that spot to, and we had not insignificant amount of money in the bank. We went from that spot in 2011 to my first 2 years in this business in 2013. I was $55,000 in credit card debt and zero money in the bank. So I started this with a list of clients about 400 deep on a legal pad.
Yeah.
I thought that'd get me 18 months. I burned through those folks in about 90 days. And, you know, I look at my dad, like I'm sitting here, my back against the wall. Like, and that, by the way, that $55,000 of credit card debt was not buying stuff and going on trips. That was groceries.
Groceries.
Yeah. That was groceries and gas in the car and cell phone bill and everything. But I mean, at this point, hey, I've sold my business. Like that's a lot of people that try to get into this business, regardless of the age, if they have an out, they take it at that point. I certainly would have.
Yeah.
But my back was against the wall. At that point, I'm 39 years old, bumping on 40. I've made my nest. I saw my dad work harder. I guess I'm not working hard enough.
Mm.
I just need to keep going. And so it took till probably 5 years ago to get back to a better position than we were when I started.
When you started.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at seven years.
Yeah. So it was Charlie Nowlin, who started our firm,
yep.
He still comes in and out. Justin's principal there now. Charlie told me when I started, he said, this is the best business in the world if you can stick around.
Mm.
He said, you're going to make a little money right when you get here, which he was right, made a little money, and then it's going to get real hard. And he said, it's going to be real hard for 2, maybe 3 years.
Wow.
But if you can get on the backside of that, he said, your income will go up every year and it'll never quit going up.
Lynn Hurst made this comment. He owns a bunch of tow trucks. Brilliant guy. Lynn Hurst made this comment. He said, if you can get through 3 years of owning your own business, you'll make it.
That's right.
And he said, he tells a story about a young guy who got into the tow trucking business. And he said, and he told him the same thing. He said, and 3 years to the day, he sold Lynn all his tow trucks because he got out.
Yeah.
So,
how about that?
3 years. No, I agree with that.
And so to answer your question, you said what else are you investing in? So my wife and I were on this march. So I thought even my I don't do estimated taxes. All that money goes into my policies, mm-hmm. and I write a tax check out of my policies
right.
every year. And
yeah.
I just keep upping that number
yeah.
every year of like, you know, what's going to go in there for estimated sure. taxes. So, but we went on this march. I was like, I want a giant pile of capital, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to find myself in this position again.
Sure.
And so we've been on that march. We've been in the same house. We bought a house in Homewood in 2004.
Okay.
Still live in it.
Good.
So we got a real small mortgage, pile of equity.
Yeah.
We've needed to make a move for a while. And so we have pulled the trigger. We're actually building a house. But what we're using policy for now is it's enabled us. I don't have to sell my house and rent one. Mm. I can do all these closing on the front end, closing on the back end, get moved in the new one, and then sell my
house.
And
then sell your house.
And so
policies allow you to do
that. Policies allow me to do that.
That's great.
And so that's you know, once we make all that transition, and then I'm gonna look to be, you know, I think real estate is one of the greatest places in the world to create passive income from. I mean, the nature of my business, you know, you get some passive income. You know, you make a dollar in a year, you get, you know, a penny or a penny and a half of passive income in years
sure.
forward from that. That starts to add up, but we'll look to deploy in some real estate opportunities once we get moved.
What is the most creative way you've seen IBC used in real estate?
Here's the way that I think is one of the most efficient ways to do it. So I have some real estate investors that got big IBC policies and they've never used them because they just keep doing the things they're doing.
Yeah.
This money just sits on the side. Whatever, that's okay. I have some folks that only use IBC and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have some folks that dabble. So Nolan in our office, I don't think
Nolan, yep.
So Nolan, if you hadn't looked him at it, I think it's, what's his TikTok now? Nolan Sandberg, just find him on TikTok.
Yeah.
Real estate investor, something like that. As opposed to trying to do the whole deal with IBC, he uses IBC for the earnest money and whatever he's got to put down. His whole strategy is to try to do an industrial real estate deal without putting a dollar of his own money in it.
Right.
But you got to bridge the gap. He ends up not having a dollar in it, but you got to bridge the gap from getting it under contract to getting a tenant.
Sure.
In order to make that happen without having any money in it.
Yeah.
And he does it just about 10 out of 10.
Wow.
He does it. But I think that's the highest and best use because it lets you be able to do more deals, right?
Yeah.
Even if you're having to use the money down. I mean, this is not any kind of education for a real estate investor like yourself. I mean, you pay cash for a deal. You're trying to buy $1 million deal. You need 200 grand of cash to close it if you're going to borrow the rest. So why wouldn't you do five of those deals, borrow money, do five of those deals with your million of cash instead of just paying cash for one and just having one of those.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I mean, I think the way he does it, even is he didn't have the 20% down in it at the end of the day because of how he works the worth the magic. You have
wow.
to go get with him on that. But that's I think that's a really good way to look at it.
So if you go back the beginning stages of this IBC journey, what would you do different?
Man, that's a great question, Thomas. Well, I'm glad I was naive, number one, because if I'd have known how hard it was going to be, I never would have started down this road. But I'm glad I started down this road.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you where, if I could go back just to post-college, Brad, like working for my dad,
yeah,
I feel like how you start your day drives everything.
Mm.
And only in the last, I would say, probably 10, 12 years have I been diligent in starting my day, time with the Lord, work out, you know, time with, you know, see my wife, have a cup of coffee with my wife, and then get my day started.
Yeah.
And it really sets a tone. I wish I would have been more diligent in that.
Yeah.
Start the day with discipline.
Yeah.
I think from Goggins, maybe somebody else, Goggins or Jocko or somebody. I have it written on my whiteboard in my office. It just says, do hard things.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, there's anything good in life, it was probably hard to get it.
Yeah.
And so instead of putting off or dreading, if something comes up that's going to be hard, just press into it. I wish I would have done that more earlier.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to take the easy way, I wish I would have done more of the hard stuff.
It's not easy because it gets you super uncomfortable, and some days you just don't want to be uncomfortable.
That's right.
And I told my kids this. Most of the time, when you go to workout or practice on the days that you don't want to be there, those are the days that you typically make the most progress.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, really difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
Really difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find clients for IBC?
You know, at this point, it's so word of mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, I have clients that are, I mean, a lot of my, I bet, well, I mean, just think back to 2023, trying to not be disingenuous here, but I bet at least 60% of the policies that I helped people put in place in 2023 were clients that already had policies that were doing more. If somebody gets this, they don't ever have just one policy.
Sure.
Because yeah, the more you do it, the more your eyes get open. And just by nature of design and the policy, you we're going to create 4 or 5 years down the road where you're going to need to do another one because paid-up rider is going to drop off.
It's going to drop off.
Loan repaid or something. And yeah. What are we going to do with this free cash flow? And yeah. But just referral, word of mouth. We get some stuff from Unlimit, our brand over there.
Yeah.
Save Yourself Podcast, where you came on. But
so what would you say the number one lead gen for you?
Current clients.
Mm-hmm. Whether they're starting another policy or them saying
their friends like, hey, you need to talk to Brad.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What does a normal week look like for you? I know you got talked about your morning routine, but give me like a Monday through Friday, like a rhythm there of like what it looks like.
In the office or just wake up to go to bed?
I would say in the office.
In the office.
Or working.
Working.
Whether you're working at home or working in the office.
Yeah. So it's funny, you know, I said way back when, seeing my dad spend a lot of time working at home at night. I try to not do that.
Me too.
Now, you're talking about a very emotional and personal thing, people's finances. If there's some sort of emergency that comes up or whatever, I'll obviously handle
absolutely.
That, right.
Absolutely. No doubt.
You know, but if it's not, you know, somebody texts me or emails me after hours, they're going to hear back the next morning.
First thing.
But I mean, my general day is one of the reasons you don't have a lot of IBC advisors out there. I feel like they're doing it the right way is because it is an extremely heavy lift on the advisor side for education and then for service.
Yes.
You sell somebody a life insurance policy that's not IBC, you know, tell somebody to call me when you die.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, it's not much to do with it there. But we are heavy service, a lot of moving money. So probably 30 to 50% of any given day is spent either passing service requests onto my admin. A lot of my clients will just reach out straight to her. It doesn't have to go to me.
Sure.
But if it's a strategy thing like, hey, thinking about doing this deal or thinking about this, you know, we might want to talk. Like we might not want to get the money from your
cost. You're helping people understand the mechanics of how to use it on a constant basis.
Yeah. I would say 70% of my day is talking to current clients about what they're going to do, how we're going to do it, versus 30 or 35% of the day talking to somebody new, trying to educate them, you know, get them headed down the right road.
Wow. Have you read the book Farming Without the Bank?
Yes.
Tell me what you think about the book Farming Without the Bank.
So I've met Mary Jo a couple times. Mm-hmm. Mary Jo Ehrman wrote that. It's been a minute since I read it. She was very close with Nelson.
Okay.
I know she doesn't say anything in there that necessarily I disagree with. I do know that. If you want to get specifics, it's been a minute since I've read it. But
I think it's as good as becoming your own banker. For me, it's not as technical when she tells it through a story. It was as eye-opening for me as anything that I've read.
Yeah.
I read it in a day.
Yeah, and it depends on mindset. It's an easy read, too. It's a little easy read. I mean, it's one of the ones, if somebody's like, hey, give me as much to read as you can. And that's what's sad. Like, not a lot of people are readers anymore.
Mm-mm.
They want to watch a video, listen to a podcast, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's in the queue of a group of 3, 4, 5 books that I would say, like, hey, you know, read that. And it depends on mindset, right? For sure, if somebody's a farmer, a blue-collar type person, for sure. And it just depends on how they've grown up, what their mindset is of what's going to resonate with them the most. I've had people tell me, you know, Nelson's second book, Building Your Warehouse of Wealth, I've had people tell me that it resonated more with them than Becoming Your Own Banker did.
Taking out Becoming Your Own Banker, what are the top 3 IBC books that people should read?
If it's only IBC, I mean, I would go Building Your Warehouse of Wealth. That's next. With Nelson. There's kind of a deep, heady one. If you're a deep, heady guy, Carlos Lara and Robert Murphy wrote a book called How Privatized Banking Really Works.
I've read that.
It's a little thicker, a little more heady. Just depends on what kind of information you like to consume. You know, there was a guy, and I don't have a copy in my desk. I don't know if I do or not. He wrote a book called The Wealthy Physician.
Okay.
And what's his name? Really smart guy. I'm drawing a blank on his name. It's a pretty good one. There's several resources. At this point now, you know, people don't ask me for books. They're like, hey, where can I watch a video or listen to a podcast about it? And so I've got a few podcasts I send people to besides ours. Lots of information you can consume out there.
Gotcha. What have we missed? What have we not covered that you feel like is important in this, the journey of IBC, the education of IBC, the misnomers of IBC?
I mean, I just think it's important. It can seem overwhelming and complicated. Go way back to what I said, like how I use mine. Anybody that either has excess capital or that's trying to accumulate excess capital, I don't know of a better way.
Sure.
Yeah. I like to use analogy when I explain things. The home equity is a great way to explain it. When you talk about your house, everybody, most people understand a mortgage and, you know, appraised value of a home and an equity line of credit. So you think about IBC, the home, the value of the home, appraised value of the home, that'd be like the death benefit.
Mm.
Your equity is your cash value, right? You have access to your equity here as you make mortgage payments, premiums.
Yeah.
Your equity rises closer to the appraised value.
Sure.
You'd hope it never catches it almost,
right?
Because you'd hope it's appreciating at a pace where your mortgage payments can't keep up.
Correct.
Which is how IBC works.
Yep.
But you're always building more and more equity, more and more access to capital.
But you
make all the rules, you control everything. There's no application. It can be made to be seem super complicated, but it is once you actually understand it, it is one of the more simple.
It's rinse and repeat.
Yeah. It's rinse and repeat.
Gotcha. Exactly right. Great. Brad, this has been great. I think the knowledge that you've got is pretty insurmountable, but I also love the fact that there's a story of resilience with starting something new in your late 30s, going into debt, something silly, but then also climbing back out of that thing. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So thank you.
I
enjoyed it, Thomas.
I appreciate it. Thanks, yeah. Brad.